Well, Matt.
Hello, Bill.
How are you doing this week?
I'm doing good. I have to tell you that the weather is so depressing. It's been raining for days and days and days here in D.C. We basically went from summer to winter, or at least to Halloween, instantly. And so I think a lot of us are dealing with, like, you know, weather depression or at least gloominess.
Well, so same up here in western Massachusetts, 3 days of serious rain. But the sun's out today, I think. You know, and fall is New England time, so I perhaps the transition away from summer, you know, goes a little bit more smoothly up here. But it certainly is a bit of a somber time as we approach the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I don't know if you have any recollections of where you were back then, Matt.
Well, you're right, Bill. It is a somber time. I had an interesting. Well, maybe an interesting for being not interesting 9/11 sort of story, because I was in Roanoke, Virginia, talking at a political seminar. So I had the weird experience of driving back into Washington, D.C. on 9/11 after the attacks. And it was very, very odd because, coming up 66, it was essentially deserted. And I think up 81, I think. And then 66, but the streets, the roads were deserted. I just kept being passed by these caravans of Jeeps and army trucks, and there were, you know, soldiers in uniform holding American flags, and the last place I wanted to go was into the city, or I was living in Arlington, Virginia at the time. It was weird coming from, you know, a place like Roanoke going into the city. So, you know, I did have a friend that I used to work with who was in one of the buildings. But otherwise, sort of an unremarkable story, except just for the somberness and the sort of eerie feeling of being on the streets. But obviously doesn't compare to what a lot of other people went through that day.
Well, of course. And I have somewhat a similar or analogous detached story. I was living in New York City at the time in Brooklyn, and I worked in Lower Manhattan. And on a normal day, I would have been on the subway under the towers around the time of the attacks, but it so happened I was in California for a wedding, and we were going to return home, I think, in a day or two, and I was woken up by a friend telling me to turn on the TV, and when I turned it on, it wasn't even cable, it was just sort of rabbit ears, and the reception was poor. And it looked odd. There was only one tower standing amongst the static, and I was befuddled for a second. And I couldn't get back home for a full week after that. So there was a weird sense that all the people that I was friends with in New York were going through a much more emotionally traumatic time than I was. And when I did get back, I did, go down to the site to see directly what happened. I used to work in the Trade Center for a summer, so I was familiar with the neighborhood. I felt all the debris in my lungs, and shortly said it probably wasn't too healthy to stay down there for too long.
Right.
It was all, you know, very odd and surreal. But I also have some recollection of to bring this back to our normal mission of talking about the impact of blogging. I have some recollection of what the blog scene was like at the time, because I wasn't blogging quite yet myself. That I started in 2002, but I was certainly on blogs then, reading blogs then, and it actually was a particularly important moment as far as actually it wasn't a moment where blogging brought unity to the nation's discourse. It probably was actually a singular moment that brought division to blog discourse, because there was this phenomenon of what was called war blogging at the time, and it was mostly a creature of the right, although I think there were some folks on the left that called themselves war bloggers. And before 9/11, Instapundit Glenn Reynolds had become kind of the gateway to blogging, sort of a one-man portal that just was a stream of links sharing what was interesting in the world. And it wasn't seen as a conservative site, and he took a pretty hard turn, or at least let his conservatism be more open after that. And I think that sparked a backlash amongst liberals saying, oh, geez, another place where is the internet going to become a conservative playground now? And I think that's what led to a burst of liberal blogging in the spring of 2002, and that's when I started around that time, because there was a sense that those viewpoints weren't being heard. And I think the nature of instant pundit very much changed after that. It ceased to be a place for everybody. It became more identified with the conservative blogosphere. And one other point I had to make it more directly to 9/11, I do think there was a lot of that word blogging centered around the notion of the media being anti-American, bending over backwards to bless our enemies and all that sort of stuff. The massive criticism of Susan Sontag, if you recall, and Andrew Sullivan before he was considered I haven't even been called a liberal these days, which is strange, because back in 9/11 he was calling the left the fifth column. So there was all those dynamics going on back then, and that very much, I think, shaped I think conservative thought towards the media, or reinforced a lot of conservative thoughts towards the media back then, and provoking similar strong reactions to the left as far as how the left approaches the media.
Well, yeah, I mean, so much. It's been 10 years, and I think everything has changed in America. Because of that, obviously, even blogging, the whole notion of blogging has impacted, obviously, a lot of other aspects of our lives, politics, civil liberties, everything's been impacted, but clearly blogging. And then, of course, as you mentioned, liberals really dominated the blogosphere through the rest of the Bush administration. Howard Dean. I actually got into blogging kind of because of Howard Dean, I would say. I was not a fan of his politically or ideologically, but a fan of what he was doing on... That's when it really caught my attention. And in 2003, when Trippie was managing his campaign, and they really started... And this is back with the meetup.com stuff was getting off the ground. It's before YouTube, even. But there was Meetup, and Howard Dean was doing a lot of blogging on his website, and that sort of got me excited and interested in it. So that's when I started doing it. And then I started my own blog, mattlewis.org, I think in 05. But clearly everyone and every aspect of our lives has been changed, some ways for the better, many ways I think for the worse. But here we are, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to be talking about this on Blogging Heads. But Bill, interesting to get your take on how it impacted the blogosphere.
Well, if we could fast forward to current events.
And speaking of which, Bill, think of all the stuff that's happening right now, right? So, I mean, this has been, I think part of the reason I'm tired is this gloomy weather, but the 9/11 10th anniversary is coming up. That's obviously huge. Big Republican debate, and then the job speech. And then let's not forget NFL football. So, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff happening this week.
Well,
right?
Matt, I'm strictly an Aussie rules football man. And the playoffs do start today, Friday night footy. It's looking like Collingwood and Geelong are the top two contenders. They've been duking out for the top spot all year, and I'm sure your eyes are transfixed at what's going to happen there.
Yes. Yes, and.
But last night was the big job speech, and I would say on the left probably got the best reaction he has gotten from the left in a very long time, perhaps over the course of the entire presidency. And that's not to say that it was uniformly showering him with praise, but there has been a pretty relentless drumbeat of negativity from the left online towards Obama, with the exception of what I've mentioned some other past segments of there is a certainly a growing pro-Obama constituency that is forming.
Ezra Klein, let me ask you that, because Ezra Klein tweeted out last night, I am not noticing a lot of convinced conservatives in my Twitter feed, lots of happy liberals though. And I want to know, why would liberals be happy with this speech. In other words, I don't see anything different that that they would like as opposed to the other many other speeches he's given. What was there some sort of dog whistle in there for you, Bill? What was it that I didn't hear?
I think the things that, to the extent that liberals did like it, and there's so many things that liberals that some liberals did not. The things to like are, one, that the focus was jobs. There's been a huge complaint that the conversation has been focused on deficit reduction. That's because of the president's actions. And just to have the conversation be about jobs in and of itself is considered a victory. Number two, that it was a very forceful speech. He was demanding action from Congress. He was not he did not sound conciliatory. Did not sound like he would do whatever it is Republicans wanted him to do. So people like that sort of fighting.
It wasn't. I mean, I think he delivered it very well. I will say that. And I think it was a campaign speech. And I don't say that. I'm not saying that just to diminish it.
I think that's an aspect of it that liberals liked, although the president put it in those terms.
Exactly.
But there's a general expectation that nothing the president can propose can actually pass, and therefore there's a hunger for the president to draw some clear lines and say, I'm for this, you're for that, and not muddle the issue with more compromises. That's been a critique from a chunk of the left. So if you go to Robert Borsuch, for example, who signs my paychecks at Campaign for America's Future, he spends a lot of time in his post today saying about how the proposals themselves fall very short of what the economy requires. The campaign generally wants bigger spending and fewer tax cuts for business, but he pointed out that it was bold enough that you could certainly put pressure on Republicans to say, okay, it's time to put up or shut up. Here's a set of historically bipartisan ideas. If you were going to take the jobs situation as an urgent crisis, you would put aside what you think is your perfect plan and pass this. And if you're not, then you risk being seen as putting, politics over the needs of the country. So the fact that Obama has created the possibility of drawing that contrast is soothing for liberals to a degree.
Right, and I think that's a good observation. I mean, I think that he was essentially daring Republicans to either support him or to oppose him. But he was daring them, and I think he delivered it very well. That's different. I mean, I don't know that it's going to accomplish anything. I don't know that any jobs are going to be created or any of this will pass. But in terms of political theater, I thought he did a pretty good job of delivering it.
Well, as far as it actually passed, I mean, I think the general perception on the left is that's not going to pass, and that nothing you can do is going to pass, and therefore it is all about trying to plant your flag and making the case to the public. The Huffington Post reporting on this did note that the White House, it does entertain the possibility of putting the American Jobs Act directly onto what the super committee produces as far as deficit reduction is concerned and making it an even grander bargain. The downside of that would be that it would have to wait longer to pass. That wouldn't pass until December. And they'd obviously much prefer it got passed tomorrow, as the president said. But if that's not realistically an option, it's better than not passing it at all. And that raises the question, do you happen to think the super committee will actually come to agreement and propose legislation and Congress would actually pass it? And there's obviously a lot of folks that think that gridlock is the much more likely possibility there.
And I think it's dangerous for either way. This is a dangerous time for Republicans, because if they are, because the way that the super committee works, right, is if they don't come to if they don't cut however much trillion dollars, if they don't come to an agreement by November, I think
the super committee has to propose by end of November, and the Congress has to pass it by the end of December.
And if they don't, some of these cuts, including cuts to defense, happen automatically.
Right.
Huge
cuts to defense and huge cuts to healthcare providers. So you have those lobbies gearing up, although there is a notion, I guess the healthcare lobby thinks that they're going to do better with the trigger than if they actually have other cuts passed the super committee. So that, I guess that side of the coin is a little more muddled. But the military certainly is sounding the alarms, saying, do the deal for Pete's sake or else we're gutted. And that certainly is going to go to the heart of, you know, certain Republicans who are going to be squeezed by
it. I think Republicans are squeezed by the super committee thing more than Democrats, for now. But, you know, I guess. Well, hey, though, let's talk about the debate, though. I think that there's a lot I can maybe, as opposed to the job speech, which is what it is. I think a lot of stuff with the debate, surrounding the debate, and of course, well, and the two stories are related, right? Because originally Obama wanted to give the speech the night of the debate, and that became a controversy. But did you see the MSNBC team after the debate? It was really laughable. They have a Republican debate at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, and as soon as the debate's over, they go to Rachel Maddow, Al Sharpton, Eugene Robinson, Lawrence O'Donnell, somebody else, and I forget who, and then they toss it to Chris Matthews. That certainly has generated a lot of controversy.
Now, how much of that do you think is MSNBC's choice, or how much of it is the Republicans' choice? I mean, are Republicans saying, I don't want to go on MSNBC to discuss the debate with a bunch of liberal hosts? I'm just going to give it a pass.
No, it's MSNBC's. It's MSNBC's fault because they could have selected. I mean, so here are the people. First of all, I'm of the opinion that election nights and debate nights, if you're hosting the debate, especially, but election nights and debate nights are very important and should be treated in a much more journalistic fashion than your typical program. I just think that they're serious. Having said that, MSNBC could have had, instead of Al Sharpton and Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell, they could have had, why not this, Joe Scarborough, Luke Russert, Chris Cillizza, Chuck Todd, Pat Buchanan.
Well, they had Peggy Noonan and Michael Steele before the debate. I know that. Into their pregame. They didn't have any airtime after the debate?
I don't think so. I watched at least for an hour after the debate, and they did not. Now, they did have a couple guests, which, you know, Steve Schmidt, not necessarily a great conservative, and Ed Rollins, not necessarily a great conservative, but at least they had a couple Republican guests. But in terms of the moderators, the people hosting it, it was really ridiculous, I would say. And again, look, Chuck Todd works for NBC. Chris Cillizza is a frequent guest and fills in for Chuck Todd on MSNBC a lot at the Daily Rundown. Luke Russert, a straight reporter. Just the idea to go to, like, Al Sharpton Republican debate.
I mean, Sharpton is now a host on the network. I mean, he's not just a guy they picked off the street. He's part of their stable of anchors right now.
MSNBC has a largely
liberal lineup of primetime, you know, opinionated anchors. You know, not traditional news anchors, you know, and, you know, obviously Scarborough is an exception to that, and I think Lawrence O'Donnell is a little more heterodox than some of the others.
I would have made the same argument with Fox. If they had the debate...
Don't they, when they have debates, only have conservatives from drive the post game?
Here's what let me tell you who I think... No, there's conservatives and then there's conservatives, right? So the post debate should not be O'Reilly and Hannity sitting around talking. It should be Chris Wallace, Brit Hume, Brett Baer, and then bring in Krautheimer, bring in Bill Kristol, bring in Kirsten Powers, bring in Nina Totenberg or whomever.
O'Donnell, I think, was driving a lot of it afterwards. And, O'Donnell, I mean, he wears different hats.
Lawrence O'Donnell would be fine as the liberal if, instead of Al Sharpton and Rachel Maddow and whomever, I think Lawrence O'Donnell would be fine if he were paired with, Chuck Todd and Luke Russert and Pat Buchanan, then Lawrence O'Donnell would be fine.
It's a free market, right? Yeah, there's no fairness doctrine. Networks do what they want to do. MSNBC clearly has an interest in appealing to its general customer base at this point.
Well, I think Republicans are stupid
Republicans
for agreeing
don't
to
like
do the
it,
debate.
They don't have to be part of that debate if they don't
and
want
they
to,
shouldn't.
Right?
They shouldn't. They're idiotic for agreeing to do that debate with Politico and MSNBC. I just think they're stupid for agreeing to do it.
Chris Matthews is no longer moderating these debates. They complained about that last time. So now you have to get Brian Williams and one of the guys from Politico.
And that was a huge upgrade, when I was at townhall.com, we wanted to do a debate that would be broadcast on townhall.com. It would be simulcast on all the Salem radio stations. Couldn't get all the candidates signed on board. There was an effort here at the Daily Caller. I don't know what happened to it. I don't know if it's going to come back. But there was an effort to do a debate with YouTube. You know, for whatever reason, hasn't happened. These Republicans are, why would Republicans at the Reagan Library submit themselves to this, to this questioning?
The questioning of the debate was bad?
Some of it was bad, but really, some of it was bad with Fox, too, in fairness. But the thing that really bothered me was the post-game analysis, which I thought they made no effort to provide. I'm not saying have me on. I'm not saying have hardcore conservatives on. I'm saying Chuck Todd, Chris Cillizza, Joe Scarborough. And then throw in Lawrence O'Donnell, and I'd be happy. But, some pretense of legitimate political analysis as opposed to what they provided, which was laughable.
Well, outside of the media criticisms, what are conservatives saying about the debate itself and the seeming narrowing of the debate to Romney and Perry? Are folks choosing sides? Are they pushing back at the narrowing? Are they saying, why don't you pay attention to Bachman and Kane and the others? Are they embracing Perry and they liked what they saw, or are they nervous, or is Romney stoking nervousness that he's not going to be electable in a general election?
I mean, these are generalities, right? I mean, everybody has their fans. Bachman has her fans. But overall, I think conservatives, including the blogosphere, is basically getting with the program that it's a two-man race, that it's between, unless something radical happens or Palin gets in or Christie gets in, which I don't think is going to happen at this point, it's between Perry and Mitt Romney. And if you saw the big fight over Social Security, where Romney essentially played the granny card, as I think Phil Klein or someone called it, versus Rick Perry, who called it a Ponzi scheme, which, by the way, Chris Matthews on Hardball essentially conceded to last night. So it's very clear that despite Michelle Malkin's I think appropriate piece vetting and questioning Rick Perry from a couple of weeks ago.
Hard on him regarding his mandatory vaccinations.
And immigration policy and a bunch of other stuff, too. But, yeah, the HPV mandatory vaccinations are one of the big issues. But I think that the conservative blogosphere is essentially coalescing around Perry. Most people are accepting the fact that it's a two-man race and that Romney is not going to be the conservative candidate, and Romney is sort of playing to the general, sort of hoping. I think Romney's hoping that Bachman or somebody, Ron Paul maybe even splits up the vote, causes Rick Perry problems. Romney stays above the fray as the sort of responsible, respectable choice, and is comes out of this well positioned to run a general election and go to the center. And look. Never been a huge Romney fan, but I think there is an argument to be made that if Romney wins the nomination, he could steal some Obama voters.
I mean, that's obviously what Romney wants conservatives to believe, right?
Conservatives are more interested in beating Obama than anything else.
Clearly that's the Romney bet. And that Romney's betting that people remember how, Bush really shot himself in the foot pushing Social Security privatization. And I think that's the subtext of Romney's highlighting Perry's stance on Social Security now and saying, look, this just does not fly in a general. If you want to win, you know, don't pick at the kamikaze candidate. Is there any sense in the blogosphere that conservative-based voters are entertaining that argument, or is it just being dismissed totally?
I mean, I think it's more of an argument. It's more an argument that I think is attractive to pundits and commentators than it is to rank-and-file voters or even rank-and-file grassroots bloggers.
I mean, that would be a problem for Romney, wouldn't it? I mean, pundits don't vote.
Well, I think it's – you're right. I mean, but I think it's the card he has to play. I mean, if you're Mitt Romney, you're not going to be the conservative favorite. So you play – you know, Perry is susceptible and vulnerable on this issue, and you play that card. But look – if I'm betting, I think you got to go with Perry right now. I mean, I think that, you know, Perry is the guy who I think is, you know, if you're a voter, you say, who is the most conservative guy that can win? And I think you think that's Perry. He's got the gravitas, the charisma. He can appeal to the establishment enough and to the Tea Party enough. And Romney's got all these big problems hanging over his head. Still, Romney care, all that stuff. So, and then just culturally, I mean, Romney seems like sort of an elite, aloof, flip-flopping, can you trust him guy versus Rick Perry, who just, you know, is very folksy. So that's where we're at. But I wanted to also talk to you, speaking of, you know, bloggers, where bloggers are on this, another interesting little dust-up happened, here we go again, sort of combining what's happening on cable news with what's happening in the blogosphere. But Laura Ingraham was in for, I think, Bill O'Reilly on Fox News the other night, and she had on, I think Ann Coulter was the guest, and Ann Coulter basically took some shots at Sarah Palin's fans, and basically saying that, you know, if you say anything bad about Sarah Palin, her fans go crazy on you, go ballistic on you. And Eric Erickson at Red State echoed that, saying at some point Sarah Palin has to take some responsibility for her supporters as Ron Paul must for his. I think this is an interesting topic because, first of all, I think it is sort of true. I mean, there are people who are online Palin supporters, and any, you know, they sort of impose rigid discipline. Any criticism of Palin is met with an immediate pushback, and that actually can have a negative effect. It can turn off people who maybe are generally pro-Palin and just happen to disagree with her on one thing. Now they're sort of being attacked, which pushes them further away from Palin. And I wrote about this the other day, Bill, at the Daily Caller. You know, this is 1968, the whole thing, Go Clean for Jean, right? Where people, you know, hippies would cut their hair and take a bath to support McCarthy so that they wouldn't turn off people. I wonder, number one, are Palin supporters online, some of them inadvertently turning off people who ought to like Palin? And number two, is it fair in this new media world to sort of, as Eric Erickson says, should Palin have to take responsibility for what her supporters say on Twitter?
I mean, I find this line of criticism very odd, particularly coming from Erickson, who's, you know, part of the blogosphere, and Coulter, who certainly is familiar with internet politics. Politicians have fans, and they're going to do what they're going to do online, and if you criticize a politician, guess what? Their fans will be upset with you, and that's part of dialogue. Why would they think you would be somehow different? I mean, now perhaps they really don't. Perhaps they're not so thick as to understand basic human nature, and they just want to, and they have some other reason to want to take Sarah Palin down a peg. Yeah, but this happened in the 2008 primaries where Hillary supporters were complaining that Obama bots were completely beyond the pale, and Obama supporters said that Hillary supporters were beyond the pale, and very nasty exchanges happened in comment threads.
Right, but here you have, Bill, here you have people who are not – these are not Romney supporters specifically – or Ron Paul supporters, or these are like Eric Erickson, who's, I guess you could say he's probably a Perry supporter, Ann Coulter, who I guess you could say is once Chris Christie. By the way, Mark Levin criticized her for that the other night. And Laura Ingraham, who I think liked Romney before. I don't know who she is. In other words, these are like more or less free agents who are all agreeing. Well, I don't want to say that. I don't know that Laura Ingraham was agreeing, but there's a sense that Palin supporters are very sensitive, and that they're pushing back on any criticism, and that it's hurting Palin in a sense.
But they must be worried. I mean, I don't want to put words in their mouth, and maybe you know and understand the concern dynamics better than me, but it would seem like there is a concern on the right that Palin supporters are so diehard that if Palin's not the nominee, that they're going to stay home. And they're essentially calling on Palin to get her supporters in line, because there's no way in hell that Palin's going to get the nomination. If she did, there's no way in hell that she would actually win the general. And I mean, if that's the actual subtext, it would make more sense just to say that, because to say you are personally responsible for what people say in online threads about you is a ridiculous standard that no politician's ever going to be able to adhere to. It's literally impossible.
Well, here's the deal, though, Bill. I think that, interestingly, the people who are most susceptible to this problem are the people who have the biggest, most rabid online fans, right? I mean, I've never had a John Huntsman troll attack me because I tweeted something bad about John Huntsman. And maybe that's because there are millions of John Huntsman fans who are very polite and understand that it would be counterproductive to attack me, because sometimes I say good things about him and sometimes I say bad things about him, and attacking me might actually piss me off. Or maybe there just aren't that many John Huntsman fans on Twitter. I mean, I'm inclined to think the latter is true, right? So, in other words, it's a double-edged sword. Having a lot of supporters, and here's how it used to work, Bill. In the old days, when you had traditional campaigns and you would go clean for Gene, you know, if you're working on a congressional race, you've always got these people who come in, and there's, you know, maybe they look like the Unabomber. You know, it's 80 degrees out, but they're wearing like a hooded sweatshirt. And they're, you know, they're concerned about the Bilderbergers or the black helicopters. And I'm sure both sides have these, but conservatives occasionally get these types who come into campaign headquarters. And what you need to convince them is, if you really want to stop the black helicopters, the way to do it is to go down in the basement with the blinds pulled and put together yard signs. But don't go door to door. You know, so in other words, you find a way to channel. You don't let your freak flag fly. You find a way to channel these hardcore yet socially awkward activists into being productive but being out of sight. Well, the internet ruins that, because everybody has a megaphone. And if you want to support my candidacy, I can no longer say, now, I don't want you going door to door or making phone calls. We want you putting together. You can't say that, because they're on Twitter. They're on. I mean, so this seems like a 21st century problem, and it's a double-edged sword, because it affects the people who are the most exciting online, right?
Well, I agree with all that. Although I think it's a problem again that you can never fully solve because of the open source nature of politics today. But you know, the Gene McCarthy issue was getting your supporters to present a good face to the broader electorate, so you'd have a chance of winning in a general election, or be seen as a plausible general election candidate. You know, it seems like what Erickson and Coulter are talking about in terms of Palin is not about trying to make Palin more saleable to the public. They're trying to say, hey, Palin, you are inherently unsaleable, and your supporters don't get it. So have them stop bitching at us. Stop having them pissing inside the conservative tent and tell them to forget about it.
Well, let me say this, though, Bill. Issue. Let me say this, though, Bill, because if, you know, I'll just to send this message out to people who want to use Twitter for activism or to advance a candidate. Do not, if you really want to help Palin, this goes for if you want to help anybody else, but if you really want to help Palin, do not be so thin-skinned, because I mean, I wrote behind me, Bill, this side, behind me, Bill, is a book that's largely favorable of Sarah Palin quotes. So I don't hate Sarah Palin. I've said very good things about Sarah Palin. I've defended her. I was when they accused her, the liberal blogosphere and liberals on Twitter accused her of, you know, essentially causing the Gabby Giffords shooting. I think I was the first national person to go after them and write about that and push back and call it utterly ridiculous and irresponsible. But I've also said when I thought Palin did something stupid. Like I said, for example, I wrote the blood libel thing. I don't think she knew what it meant.
Right.
Maybe I'm wrong, but so I'm not like in the tank.
You're not
for
wrong.
Her. I'm sympathetic to her, but I'm not in the tank for her. But psychologically, and I try not to let people influence me as much as I can, but psychologically, if I say something bad about Sarah Palin and I'm attacked for it on Twitter, people, you know, come at me swinging with, you know, guns a-blazing. My instinct, and maybe this is just me, it's not my gut instinct isn't, wow, I don't want to be attacked anymore, so I better not say anything bad about Palin. No, my instinct is now it's me against them. They're actually, I think, to a lot of people, they're not scaring them into submission. They are creating. Well, this is, Bill, this sort of goes to what the liberals say we're doing in Afghanistan or Iraq, right?
Oh, I think it's
we're creating terror.
That your crazy online fans do not help you.
Yes.
As far as their online interactions are
they
concerned.
Are radicalizing the anti-Palin forces.
But this is something that, I mean, but there are going to be crazy Rick Perry online fans are going to say crazy things. I mean,
where are they, though? I haven't seen them.
Well, they'll come. It will happen. And look, Obama's got crazy online fans.
I'm against anyone who
wants to
impose.
Has crazy online fans. Any politician who has some modicum of intense support is going to have crazy online fans.
And I'm against anyone who wants to impose discipline and stifle legitimate argument and criticism.
You know, you may disagree with this, Matt, but you know, I think there's some people taking pause at the audience reaction at the last debate to what Perry had to say about the death penalty. You know, it's one thing to be supportive of the death penalty. It's another thing to sort of revel in the blood
right.
and gore that comes with it. And that's something that, you know, Perry didn't try to restrain that crowd audience there. He bathed in its glory, and that kind of reaction, you know, might not be helpful in a general election. It might be, maybe it won't. Maybe nobody cares. Maybe the majority of the public is in the same boat. But it certainly raises an eyebrow. And that's not a blogging thing or an online thing, but it's an example of perhaps an intensity of support that blinds you to perhaps how you are portraying yourself is going to be seen, you know, by different constituencies. So Perry might very well have that kind of issue if he gets to the general election phase.
A few points. Number one, have you ever seen the Ron White, They Call Me Tater Salad, stand-up comedy bit?
I've seen Ron White. I've not seen that.
This is like the blue collar comedy tour. Check. He has a great thing about Texas.
He is the best part of the blue collar comedy tour, by the way.
He is, without a doubt. But he has this skit, and I swear to you, I thought Rick Perry was going to do the skit because Perry started out just like he says, you know, if you come to Texas and kill one of our citizens, we will kill you back. That's what Rick, you know, Ron White says, and then he says some states. He's like, some states are trying to outlaw the death penalty, and Texas, we're putting in an express line. And, of course, that gets huge laughs. I don't fault Perry. I thought it was weird when the audience applauded sort of preemptively, even before he spoke. And here's my take. I mean, I do support the death penalty, but I think it's a very solemn, serious thing. And when the death penalty is needed, it's because humanity has failed, society has failed. It shows our fallen nature as people. Is that something to be cheered or you know? So I thought it was inappropriate. I don't blame Rick Perry at all, but I think it did make the audience look bad for what it's worth. So it's my take on it. But check out Ron White because he is quite funny.
I agree. Ron White is funny. should we end it on that note, Matt? Or is there more to say?
Well, there's a lot more to say, but I think...
We haven't said everything? We haven't solved all the problems of the universe?
Well, we'll be back in a couple weeks to do that. So stay tuned, everybody.
Stay tuned for the solving of everything.
That's right. But a good week, an exciting week, a lot of stuff going on, a lot of serious stuff going on. But always good talking with you, Bill.
You too, Matt.
All right, man.
And we'll see you next week on the Week in Blog.
Take care. You got it. Thanks.